Good evening, everybody.
Hello and welcome to Disney Magic Hour, episode number 107. On this week's show, it is part 6 of our great movie ride film series featuring Raiders of the Lost Ark. To my left, as always, is Melissa. Say hello, Melissa.
Hello, Melissa.
Joining us via Skype is Ryan Wilson. Say hello, Ryan.
Hello, Ryan.
And also joining us via the same device is Courtney Van Ren. Say hello, Courtney.
Hello, Courtney.
Hello, Pete. And say hello, Pogo. This episode of Disney Magic Hour is brought to you by MEI Travel. For all your vacation planning needs, or visiting Walt Disney World, taking a cruise, traveling anywhere, possibly becoming a radio to God, visit the experts over at meitravel.com, where Becky and her team can get you started on your own adventure. Right now, you're listening to There You Are. You can find this track and more over at soundcloud.com/pogomix. His website is pogomix.net. We are lastgenpodcast.com. Find us on Twitter at Diz Magic Hour Pod. That's D-I-S Magic Hour Pod. You can find us on the Facebook. Our group is called Disney Magic Hour. If you're already there, add your friends. If not, add yourself. You can find this show on iTunes, Google Play Music, and Stitcher. Melissa, where can everyone find the Instagram account?
Instagram is at Disney Magic Hour Podcast.
And where can people find our Patreon if they'd like to become production assistants in our wee team here?
You can go to patreon.com/DisneyMagicHour, and there you'll be able to sign up and join our crew.
Excellent, excellent. And Ryan, where can everyone find the voodoo that you do?
They can find it at mainstgazette.com. That's the main site for Main Street Gazette. If you use the Main ST Gazette for Twitter or Instagram, you'll find us there. And we also have a Facebook page. Just search for Main Street Gazette on Facebook.
Places to go, people to see, idols to steal, archaeology to smash into pieces. This is the Disney Magic Hour. I would also just take a moment. Hello, Courtney. Good morning.
Hello, Peter. Good morning.
How are you?
Very well, thank you. And yourself?
Technology is keeping me up at night, every night. The last two nights in a row, I've been up till about 3 or 4 in the morning. Just messing with things and trying to get everything to work the way it is supposed to. So the lesson is, smash technology. Don't do it. Mr. Brian Bogart is out sickly this week, so he shall return maybe next week.
Sure.
Maybe. We shall see. But he's under the weather, so hope you feel better, Mr. Bogart. And we have a hell of a film to talk about this week. Some of the movies that we've come into during this series, a lot of them were, well, that's a fair amount of them, were movies that many people know of but never actually sat down and watched. I would say that was the majority so far of the films that we've hit, maybe with the exception being last week with Alien. Most people have seen that film or parts of that film. This week we have a movie I don't really think that we can say is one of the under-the-radar films, because it was such a sensation, such a pop sensation. It has, it's an ongoing thing as well. And it was, the early 80s, and it was, created by the dynamic duo, basically, of Hollywood at the time, and would still be considered that, now even more so. And Raiders of the Lost Ark is just one of the more popular films pretty much ever made.
Yeah.
So I don't think that, was there anyone on this side of the microphones that did not see Raiders of the Lost Ark previous to it coming up in this?
No, definitely not.
Yeah.
No.
So it's kind of, I don't think it's weird. I was excited to talk about it because I saw that other people got so excited, to see it come up and, do the thread, which unfortunately we missed. How was the thread on Thursday?
Oh, it was great. It was a lot of fun. Everyone, the GIF game or GIF game was a little late to it this time, but everyone had a lot of fun.
All right, good.
It was Wednesday.
It was Wednesday. Okay.
Did you want to mention what we did on Wednesday?
I don't remember what we were doing.
We were in a very special place. Eating wonderful food.
All right. So Chuck E. Cheese.
No.
Starts with Golden.
Golden Corral.
Oh, no. Ew. You are terrible at this game.
God.
We had the privilege to go.
Or am I
go...
great at it?
No.
Yeah, you're great at this game.
We had the privilege to go to Golden Oak and eat at the Summer House.
Yes.
Which was really fantastic. The food was really fantastic. There was an Italian sausage there that you said was...
Italian sausage pasta, yeah. It actually tastes like Italian food.
Yeah.
Shocking. But yeah, it was great. We were there for a couple hours.
Yeah, it was like a 2-hour event.
It was more of a buffet. It was a buffet. It wasn't more like a buffet. It was a buffet. You didn't sit down and order a meal, you know, via a menu or anything like that. They just had food laid out.
So just like Golden Corral.
It was. I'm telling you, it was Golden Corral. Golden Corral with the man playing piano.
Yeah.
Like, who's supposed to be there? Not Classy. Just like some dude playing a piano. I don't know. Yeah, I had a good time. It was good.
It was good. You put up some of the pictures from the Triple R room, which was probably one of the best rooms.
Yeah, yeah. There was a lot of great art, Disney art and wall panels, you know, that were painted towards Disney. And it was nice to kind of see some of that. Like, they had the original, some original art for Pinocchio and for Disneyland, like a lot of original concept art, one of them in particular for Dumbo.
Yeah, it was the map, I think, also of Disneyland a little bit.
I want to say that was Epcot. I forget which one it is, but I could look it up.
Okay.
But yeah, they had a bunch of really cool Disney history pieces up there, and then they had food. So that was a workable combination.
Yeah. It was cool.
You know, you weren't allowed anywhere near people's like houses because that's just rude and creepy. But, you know, I can imagine... not living with the specter of cash, you know, every day looming over your head, just waiting to kill you slowly over time. It must be nice. I don't know. Must be cool to have a place where you're like, bills, we'll get to them. But, you know, the place is, it's incredibly gorgeous. And it was a nice day out. And, thank you very much to the Lozadas, Jason and Desi, for, you know, inviting us over to that event. And, yeah, we had a great weekend with them, basically. You know, we hung out with them pretty much all weekend. And last night we went to Flying Fish to experience... This was part of the Magical Dining, right?
They had it. We didn't go with that menu, though.
Yeah, we didn't go with that menu. But we took advantage. They have a little recent promotion. The Tables in Wonderland is at 30% off right now for select restaurants. So we went over to Flying Fish. We met up with them and, and then the Cacciatore's.
Yeah.
And it was great. We just had a really good weekend.
Had one of the best cheese plates I think I've ever had on property.
Yeah, that might be the winner over at Flying Fish for the cheese plate. That might actually be the number one thing. And I had octopus, which I have not really ever had octopus. Or the times that I did, it was very like squishy and I didn't like it. This was totally great. So that was news. And now we have kind of a Disney day planned out today because, well, in a sense, because Studio Ghibli was a distributor for Studio Ghibli for a number of years. And we're going to go see Nausicaa today. And then we have tickets from Mulan is having a big screen appearance tonight at 6:00. So, have some stuff coming up. All right. So you want to go back to the movie?
Yes.
All right, great.
Sorry about that.
I have no idea what I was talking about. What was I talking about?
Raiders.
Raiders of the Lost Ark, folks. You want to talk about Raiders of the Lost Ark?
Let's talk about Raiders of the Lost Ark.
All right, great. Let's just jump into this. So Raiders of the Lost Ark was released on June 12th, 1981, and it was released on an $18 million budget. It would go on during its lifetime to pull in $390 million, but that year alone, 1981... it racked up $212 million in 1981. It was the number one box office film of the year. You want to know what number two was? On Golden Pond. You want to know what it brought in? 119.
I've never seen that.
You never seen On Golden Pond?
Never
it's really
heard of it.
Good. It's really good. You old poop! It also racked up 8 Oscar nominations.
Oscar?
Oscars, folks. We're going to do a show, the yearly Noscars. It'll be all the films that shouldn't be nominated for anything. It's like the Raspberries, but like funnier. Anyways, it racked up 8 Oscar nominations, including Best Picture. It actually lost to Chariots of Fire, which, you know, It was also nominated for Best Director, Cinematography, Original Score, and for, oh no, well, yes, and Special Achievement Award for Ben Burtt, who also made the lightsaber noise, for Sound Effects Editing. It won for Best Visual Effects, Film Editing, Sound, and Art Direction. It was just a massive... This is like one of the last pure action films that gets this much recognition. It kind of doesn't do it again till... You could say... I guess you could say Braveheart would be in there. And then, of course, Lord of the Rings would be in there as well. I'm probably missing one. But when we go for just pure action film... I feel like they're not taken very seriously nowadays. Like they come out and they can be incredible. Like The Raid is an incredible action film, but it would never get it like an Oscar nod. It just wouldn't happen.
Was Mad Max Fury Road? I know that. That's a
good one. Yeah, no, that's a great like recent addition that did actually get, but it didn't win.
Didn't it win for art? I'll look it up.
I don't remember. I don't care if it won for art because that's the kind of things that they throw at films like this. And they're like, well, you're not going to win any of the real awards because that's how they look at it. That's how they look at
it. They'll give it special effects. They'll give it all those those technical kinds of things, but it's not going to get any of the main categories.
Yeah, double check if it won Best Director because I'm almost positive it did not. So, there we go. You know, it was a really huge thing, but where did it all start? And funny enough, the story of Indiana Jones starts with a man named Smith back in 1973. And Ryan, what can you tell us about the story of the good doctor and how he came to be?
Mr. Smith Goes to Star Wars?
Smith Goes to Star Wars.
So this is a story that was bubbling around in George Lucas's mind since really around the time of American Graffiti. Right after he'd finished that, he had this idea. He also had this idea for this space opera that he kind of sort of wants to do. He talks to his good friend Philip Kaufman, who helps him come up with the name, which is Indiana, which is based off of George Lucas's dog, and this name Smith, because they wanted this everyman kind of a name. Kaufman also comes up with this idea of, what he should be going after is this Ark of the Covenant. That should be our big prize that we're going to go after. So George Lucas takes all this information. Philip Kaufman is kind of sort of tapped to direct at that point, talking to him. At least in their minds, that's how they're going to play this game. And then George Lucas goes off to create his space opera, Star Wars. He goes, that's where his main focus is. That's his main drive. So he gets away for the opening weekend of Star Wars. He's afraid it's going to just truly bomb. He's afraid it's not going to do well. So he takes off and goes on vacation to Hawaii, where Steven Spielberg also happens to be. He's getting away from the post-production on his big space movie, Close Encounters of Third Kind. So the two of them start talking once it's really clear that Star Wars is going to just be this overwhelming success. And you have Spielberg talking about how what he's really always wanted to do with a James Bond movie. He wants to do something with James Bond. And George Lucas goes, well, I have that beat. I want to go back and do like the RKO serials type hero, like this big, just action-packed kind of hero, harkening back to those serial kind of days. And they start talking about it, and they're like, you're right, we should absolutely do this movie. And they start kind of shopping around, and this is, like we said, the two major hero, two major box office sells at the time, and they can't really get anybody to pick it up.
Yeah.
And so they call in, and they have their friend Lawrence Kasdan, who has done everything from The Big Chill to Empire Strikes Back, The Bodyguard, Accidental Tourist. Like he has a pedigree for writing, and they bring him in, and he helps them kind of refine it. They go away from the word Indiana Smith because they think we don't want that's too close to Nevada Smith, which was a movie that had been released a couple of years prior. So they go, okay, well, what about Jones? Great, fine, Jones. That works just fine. And to help them kind of, they finally get this movie picked up. It's going to be Paramount, and it's going – and so they're starting to look at where they're going to go with this. and they bring in Jim Steranko, which had, you know, an enormous illustrating career, but mostly for Nick Fury S.H.I.E.L.D. from Marvel. And he does, if you've seen that, if you've ever seen any of the pre-production artwork from Raiders of the Lost Ark with Indy with the hat, with the cigarette kind of hanging out of his mouth and the desert in the background, all the jungle scenes, if you've ever seen any of that, that's all Jim Steranko. And so he helps them storyboard and get these great paintings that truly harken back to these serial days. And so now they have their artwork, they have their story, and they're ready to head off.
Yeah, and, you know, kind of going back a little bit on what you were saying with Paramount Pictures, so, you know, you were speaking about how they couldn't get the film off the ground initially, all right? So this is Spielberg, yeah. Steven Spielberg and George Lucas. But we have to remember, Spielberg, very successful in the box office game, but is getting a reputation, and this is funny when you think of Spielberg this way, of not coming in on time and being way over budget. Yep. Because Jaws and Close Encounters, way over budget, hugely over time. And then 1941 is the film that follows it. It's both those things and a bomb.
Yeah.
So Spielberg is kind of looking for a rebound in this. And the Paramount Pictures president at the time, does anyone want to take a wild guess at who that man was?
Oh, I know who it was.
Anyone else?
No.
Who is it, Ryan?
It's a little man known as Michael Eisner.
Yep. Oh. Michael Eisner. He did not want to. Now, they pitched it to him, and he had pretty much the same reaction everyone else, mainly because of the deal they wanted. It was basically a thing where you have to finance this film, but you have no rights over a sequel without our involvement. You cannot do it. And also, it was a thing where, you know, everyone was worried about Spielberg going over budget. But Eisner didn't want to pass up on a film that was made by these two guys.
Yeah.
Because he was like, well, it's got to make money, right?
Yeah.
So he agreed to their terms and whatnot, but he also had them agree to, hey, if you go over budget, you're going to get a penalty to the money that you are earned. And then they also worked it out that Spielberg, Lucas, and Lucasfilm all made $1 million each, flat. And then they would receive, well, Spielberg would receive a percentage of gross profits. So that means, like, whatever they made in the box office, he would get a percentage of that. Lucas put himself one step beyond that, sort of in the risk category. He would receive only net profits. So again, if this movie was over budget and it didn't make the money, Lucas pretty much wouldn't make any money off of it. He would just make the $1 million that he got as a sign-on bonus. So Michael Eisner was the one who really put together Indiana Jones in front of the screen. And that is crazy. So with all of that sort of in mind, Spielberg and Frank Marshall, who was also a producer on the film, they publicly, well, you know, as in like with the production company and all that, they made an 85-day shooting schedule. But then Spielberg and Marshall kind of went to the side and they crafted a 73-day shooting schedule to then give themselves additional time if they lost anything going forward. This was the start of Spielberg always coming in on time, always being, you know, under budget and blah, blah, blah. It starts with this film because he wanted to change that reputation that he was sort of getting as not being, as being incredible, but sort of, you know, loose with all the other stuff. So he also taps Douglas Slocum to become his cinematographer, who would actually go on to shoot all of the Indiana Jones films. He was also the cinematographer on the original. And I'm going to say original because a lot of these movies have been ripped off and redone a number of times. The Italian Job, Rollerball, Never Say Never Again, The Servant, Great Gatsby, Julia, which actually those last three films, Servant, The Great Gatsby, and Julia, all won him BAFTAs at the times, which is basically the, you know, the British Oscar for cinematography. Also, very famously in this film, he never used a light meter, which is insane.
Yeah.
He shot the whole film without using a light meter. He just knew it by eye, which is absolutely incredible that one has the capacity to do that. So they have a budget in place. They have their production team in place. They need a cast. Melissa, Tell us, oh, about casting, please.
They get a cast. I went down a rabbit hole with this cast. There was definitely a couple of things that were really interesting. So we'll start out with our main guy, Indiana Jones. We have Harrison Ford playing him. But initially, Lucas didn't want Harrison Ford because he didn't want him to become his quote-unquote De Niro, how Scorsese always used De Niro in his films. He didn't want Ford to become known as like his De Niro. Like, he always uses him in his films.
Because that didn't work out for everyone involved.
But obviously, Spielberg pushed for him, and he... had a couple other people, though, that did try out.
Yes. I want to talk about this.
Notably, I think the big one is Tom Selleck.
No. I officially don't think this... I'm going to argue this. What?
Nothing. Go ahead.
You killed Melissa.
You did.
I'm
it's
sorry.
Okay. Go ahead.
Well, let's talk about who was there before Tom Selleck, though. That's why.
Okay. Go ahead.
The dude. Jeff Bridges. I didn't know this. I found this out through doing this. Jeff Bridges was one of the people who was considered before Tom Selleck. Jeff Bridges.
That would have just been...
That would have been weird.
Weird, yeah.
Like, weird. I can kind of see Tom Selleck. Like, because this is like... The Tom Selleck thing is pretty well known at this point.
Yeah.
Like, and you can kind of see that. And man, it's the stash and whatnot. But Jeff Bridges... I don't know. But this is around Tron era. So it's a very different Jeff Bridges than, like, what we know as Jeff Bridges now.
Yeah.
I just, that is so weird to me, though.
Yeah.
But yeah, Jeff Bridges. But yes, the bigger thing was that, it wasn't that Spielberg was like pulling for Harrison Ford. They had their man in Tom Selleck, but. Yeah.
But Magnum PI was the thing that kind of broke it because the schedule for that took precedent and he couldn't, break that. So.
Do you think he regrets that? I mean, Magnum P.I. is a massive hit. Like, Tom Selleck's had a hell of a career. Like, there's no denying it. Like, it's incredible. Do you think Tom Selleck wishes that he busted that contract? I mean, he probably doesn't. Like, because, oh, well, I'm still a millionaire. Because, who cares? But, like, do you think there's a part of him who's like, I should have just busted my contract?
I don't know. I couldn't say maybe.
Oh, yeah. That'd be weird. Do you think it still works? Is it possible? That film is, obviously it's different without Harrison Ford, but does it still work?
Yeah.
I don't know. I haven't watched Tom Selleck in Magnum P.I., so, like, I'm only really remembering him from, like, Three Men and a Baby, so, like, to me,
he's
comedy than, like, I like Harrison Ford's, very blunt, like, one-liner.
Yeah, I wonder if it wouldn't end up a little bit more, like, Romancing the Stone. Like, I wonder if it wouldn't end up a little bit more to that side of the camp, almost, of it than what we got. And I wonder if that affects the longevity of the series then.
Yeah, because I feel like a lot of the quotes like that were delivered by Harrison Ford.
They're
kind of
dead. They're Harrison Fordy.
Yeah.
As well as Chewy. Whips and Leia. Gonna do things, Luke.
I don't think that's accurate.
That's actually pretty damn accurate, actually. So Tom Selleck, CBS is like, no, we're not going to release him. And then Spielberg, during a screening of Empire Strikes Back, says,
this guy.
Why not this guy? And did you read the story of how he brought it up to George Lucas?
No.
He goes up to Lucas and he's like, I got the perfect guy. And George Lucas, without even looking up, he's like, Harrison? He's like, yeah. He's like, yeah, I should just do that. It's just, I don't know. It's like, because as you were saying, like, he didn't want to get that reputation for being like a great director paired with a great actor. I don't know. What does that even mean? He didn't want that reputation. But,
should we all not have that problem in our lives?
Yeah, I guess he knew it the whole time. He just didn't want to go with that.
I guess, yeah.
So the right man for the right job at the right time. Hire your carpenters, folks. That's how it works. They're all great actors, evidently.
Yep. Do you want me to give a list of some of his movies, or we're good with
Harrison
that?
Ford?
Yeah.
Why not? Maybe people haven't heard of him.
I mean,
I don't know.
He's in the little franchise. It's called Star Wars. He's in Blade Runner and the upcoming Blade Runner 2049.
Oh my God, it looks so good.
The Frisco Goodness. Kid, Witness, Apocalypse Now.
The Frisco Kid.
Sorry, that's a typo.
No, that is not a typo. That is the movie.
Oh, okay.
It is with Gene Wilder. Gene Wilder plays a Hasidic Jew, and they're in the West, and it is absolutely hysterical.
Oh, I think I've seen that.
It's great. It's a awesome. Great film.
And then he goes to other ones like Witness, Apocalypse Now, Patriot Games, The Fugitive, Clear and Present Danger, 6 Days, Seven Nights, What Lies Beneath, Ender's Game, which I haven't watched, but I heard was pretty good.
Did you?
Well, like...
Who told you this? I don't know. I hadn't heard very much great things about that one.
I've heard like a couple people who read the book who were like, yeah, it was pretty good.
All right. That sounds... But that, like, that's on the DVD code. Yeah, it's pretty good.
It's pretty good.
Guy who read book. That's the quote.
Says guy. But yeah, he's had some type of career.
Yeah.
Shall we go with his co-star, leading lady, Miss Marion Ravenwood, played by Karen Allen. Originally for this role, I found that Deborah Winger was going to be cast. You might know her from An Officer and a Gentleman in Terms of Endearment. But she actually turned it down.
I like Deborah. I mean, honestly, there's a lot of people who, if you put Deborah Winger and Karen Allen in front of them, they wouldn't be able to tell you the difference. But there's a spunk to Karen Allen that Deborah Winger, I feel like she kind of has, but not nearly the way that Karen Allen does it.
Yeah.
Karen Allen has a childish, like a childlike wonder to her in a lot of stuff. It's also, I saw her, she was in a really cool film version of, what is it, Gentlemen Callers. What's that play? Glass Menagerie with John Malkovich. And, you know, she's kind of like the kid in that play. And you can see like pieces of Marion a little bit. Cause like Marion's a toughie, but she's got like this childlike playfulness also to her. And I don't know if Deborah Winger does that much. Deborah Winger can do like the hard ass woman, you know, like she could do the tough parts. I don't know about the childlike kind of pieces to Marion though.
Yeah.
So it worked out.
It did. Karen Allen got her film debut in Animal House. So that was where they kind of saw her spunk and decided that would be a good fit for this role.
Yeah.
She was also in The Wanderers in 1979, which I thought was cool. It was also directed by the same director who we'll see in a little bit, Philip Kaufman. She was in A Small Circle of Friends, which was directed by Rob Cohen, who was also the director of XXX and The Fast and Furious. So I thought that was kind of an interesting piece.
Yep, those are movies.
And she was also in Starman, which was Jeff Bridges there. So
Harrison Ford.
Could have been her.
Harrison Ford should have been Starman. Jeff Bridges could have been Indiana Jones. Everything would have worked out.
And
from Stars.
I think one of my favorite other Karen Allen movies was Scrooged.
Yeah. Yeah, that's great. Stop the goddamn hammering is one of my favorite lines of all time. Whenever I'm in a place where it's loud and I'm trying to talk with somebody, I just instantly hear Bill Murray saying that line. Could you please stop the goddamn hammering? That's all I ever hear. I love it.
I love that one.
And again, the same thing in there. Like she has like a childish sort of wonder to like, it's just her eyes. Like she just does it without trying. She has it in her eyes.
Yeah.
It's very lively.
We'll go on to our counterpoint to Dr. Jones. Dr. Belloc is played by Paul Freeman.
Belloc.
Belloche.
Belloche. This man Belloche. He's very clever. Can we just quote the movie the whole way through?
Yeah, sure.
It's going to happen anyway.
Yeah. Spielberg casted him after seeing him in a movie called Death of a Princess. And this kind of, he kind of has like this role of playing a villain.
Yeah, yeah. He's got the face.
Yeah. He was in The Long Good Friday, which was also starred Bob Hoskins. He was in Dogs of War, which also starred Christopher Walken. And I found a really cool movie. He was, he actually played Professor Moriarty in a movie called Without a Clue, which also starred Michael Caine.
I remember that film.
The poster's really cool looking. It almost has a very Christmas Carol like silhouette of Michael Caine.
Michael Caine. All right, good.
So, if you're young like me, you might also remember Belloc. He played Ivan Ooze in the 1995 Mighty Morphin Power Ranger movie.
Everyone has a low point.
Oh. And then I thought this was cool. In 2008, he kind of got acclaim again in London. He played George Aronow in Glengarry Glen Ross.
You're forgetting. Are you seriously forgetting the one thing that we need to talk about with him? Not one thing. He's amazing, but
I have it written.
Okay, good.
Sorry, my eyes bypassed over it. He was also in Hot Fuzz.
The greater good. He was a priest. He was a priest in Hot Fuzz, just so you know. Everyone knows. Okay, so that's our man, Belosh.
Yeah. And then we have, I guess, our even worse villain, Major Tot.
Yes.
Right? That's how you say it?
Yeah.
He's played by Ronald Lacey. This was originally offered by Spielberg to Roman Polanski, which I thought was really interesting.
He looks like Roman Polanski, and I want to say around this time... it must have been later where things got creepy with the Polanski fellow. I believe this was pre-creepy. I don't remember, though. I have to look into it. But, yeah, he kind of looks like him. Honestly, if you put a picture of Polanski next to Ronald Lacey, they're sort of similar looking.
Yeah. And then this is where I kind of got interesting. So Ronald Lacey, He starred in movies. He was in Firefox with Clint Eastwood. He was in Sahara with Brooke Shields, and Red Sonja with Arnold Schwarzenegger. And then here's his other Disney tie-in. He was in a movie called Trenchcoat, which I had never heard before. He actually performs his role in full drag. He's cast as Princess Ada.
Sure.
But one of the stars of this film is Margot Kidder, who played Lois Lane in the Christopher Reeve Superman. And I I posted the poster for Trenchcoat in our Patreon group. I just love the tagline on the poster.
Don't watch this.
No, it says, to write a great novel, you have to live a great novel. Too bad Mickey writes murder mysteries. I just think that's
a
great.
Good. That's some 80s tag.
It
that's
is.
Some 80s tag right there.
And I love that Margot's character's name is Mickey. So Mickey writes murder.
I mean, sure. When does this come out? When did that come out? What was the release date?
It was, hold on.
Don't worry about it. It's
no,
okay.
I have it right here. It was 1983.
That sounds about right. Yes. I mean, we'll look into it. We'll look into it.
It kind of sounded interesting.
That's the most I'm going to give you on that one.
We've agreed to a couple of things before that we've regretted later.
Yeah. Before announcing things, I may have to pre-screen some of these movies because, woof.
I thought it would be worth it because it did have Lois Lane in it. So
there's a lot of things that have Margot Kenner in it. Not all of them are worth it. All right, there is a line there. So
all right. Let's move on to Sala.
Well, I just want to say there's just one little thing. He does actually pop up in Last Crusade. He's one of the Gestapo.
Oh, yes.
Just as like a nice nod. He's in there. Just a nice little nod. But let's talk about Sala.
Sala. He's played by John Rhys Davies.
Yes.
Originally in this role, Spielberg wanted Danny DeVito.
Sure.
Which I think would have been great.
Makes sense. Makes perfect sense.
But again, scheduling conflicts.
But it ties into a comment that Ryan sort of made passingly just a couple of moments ago, where you said if Tom Selleck was in it, it may have been sort of more like Romancing the Stone. Well,
surprise.
surprise, Romancing the Stone is a massive, you know, ripoff, sort of trying to leap off the coattails of Indiana Jones. And who shows up on set? Danny DeVito. So, and that movie is... great. The first movie's great.
Yeah.
The second movie's got a great song, Billy Ocean. Ooh, want to touch you.
I don't know that one.
Is a lover too.
Nope.
Ooh, want to hold you. That's the only reason I'm going to go see Billy Ocean at the BT. I don't care about Get Out of My Dreams, Get Into My Car. I want to hear them when the going gets tough. So, okay, I'm sorry. Yes, John Rhys Davies. Tell me about him.
I guess he would be, for me, most notable as Gimli from Lord of the Rings.
Yes.
He was also in The Untouchables, Sliders, Robin of Sherwood, The Living Daylights, which was a Bond film.
The Living Daylights.
We'll see him again in Last Crusade. He was in The Lost World from 1992. He was also in Princess Diaries 2.
I love how you picked up on that one.
I did. I had to throw in every, you know, once in a while. But here's also some really good stuff. He did a lot of voice acting work also.
Yes.
So yeah. I picked up some really good ones. I'll put that in quotes. Really good ones being he voiced Kasim in Aladdin and the King of Thieves. That's yep. Aladdin's father. He also voiced Ranjan's father in The Jungle Book 2.
Yes.
He was the narrator of Boo to You, Winnie the Pooh, which was a Halloween special. And currently he is in The Lion Guard. He plays King Sokwe, which I haven't seen, but I've heard that is a really good show.
Okay.
He also played Macbeth in Gargoyles, which 80s kids love Gargoyles.
Yes.
He also played Man Ray in SpongeBob SquarePants, so that's good stuff.
Yep.
And he also has a role in The Shannara Chronicles, which I've heard is really good, and I really want to watch it.
Yeah?
Yeah, also that...
I've been asking that a lot when people are like, the movie's really good. I'm like, yeah.
No. That's a TV series with...
I thought that was a movie, too.
The guy who played Deathstroke and Arrow.
Okay, yeah.
I forget his name. It's Manu something, but...
Yeah, it's okay.
Yeah, so... I got to check out that series.
Oh, and just in case anyone was maybe slightly confused, Lost World, not the dinosaur thing. It was an adaptation of the actual book, Lost World. He plays Dr. Challenger.
Yeah.
Just to clarify that, just in case anyone's wondering where Gimli was during the dinosaurs getting kicked in the face by gymnasts and stuff like that.
He was the dinosaur.
He was the dinosaur. He was also, you know what? Yes, he was Gimli. Everyone knows him as Gimli. He was also Treebeard. He did the voice of Treebeard in Lord of the Rings, and he did it by breathing in. He would talk while breathing inward. So,
it sounds about
how
right.
about that?
We got Brody
Tree
up last.
Brody, yes.
How do you say that? Denholm.
Yeah, Denholm Elliott. Yes.
Okay, Denholm Elliott. He was also in a movie with Michael Caine called Alfie. Mm. He was in.
What's it all about, Alfie? Nothing? Okay, good.
I've never seen it, so no.
Never heard that song, evidently, either. It's a song. It's got to be a Burt Bacharach. It was a big song.
Okay.
So.
He was also in A Room with a View in 1985, which starred Maggie Smith, Helen Bonham Carter, Judi Dench, and Julian Sands. So mm-hmm. that had a great cast also.
Yes.
We'll see him again in Last Crusade. He was in 1983 Trading Places, which was directed by John Landis, who also directed Animal House. So we have a couple tie-ins there.
If you've never seen Trading Places, improve your life and rent Trading Places now. Now.
Okay. I'll do that later.
Okay.
And he was also in The Razor's Edge, which starred Bill Murray. And then he was
That was like Bill Murray's like first dramatic role.
Yeah.
Really good, too.
And he was also in an Australian miniseries called Bangkok Hilton with Nicole Kidman and Hugo Weaving. So...
And then, actually, I just want to... You have this in there. Do you have that in there? Just read that. Just go ahead.
He was also in Noises Off?
Noises Off was his last film. This is the only reason I want to bring it up. It was his last film, and it's really great. It's an adaptation of a stage play. I want to say John Ritter is in it as well. It's really, really fun. And if you've never seen it, and that also got Michael Caine, Carol Burnett. Priya Bogdanovich was the director. It's really good. It is just good slapstick fun stage work, and he doesn't have a big role in it. I almost feel like he has like barely any lines in that role, but it's really fun. Noises Off. I think you would really like it, Melissa. It's a lot of fun.
Okay, cool. And just last but not least, this is the film debut of Alfred Molina.
Yes. Dr. Octopus himself.
But he's in it.
Yep, he's in there. It's always great to see him. When in that, it's got a memorable role. He's not in it very long, but a memorable role.
It's got that same look.
So we've got our cast. Everyone is ready to, you know, to get going. And then we go into the filming, which I'm just going to say that this is the old days where, like, you went to places. And I think it always works out very well. So starting off, they actually went June 23rd, 1980. This film starts filming in La Rochelle in France. It also went to Elstree Studios for the interior shots, South America, where they did some more. Then they went back to Elstree Studios, did the Well of Souls, where all the snakes and everything were there. Guess what? A cobra killed a python on set. Also, Spielberg would just throw snakes at Karen Allen to get her to scream at the right times. So remember all the good stuff that, like, I may have said, like, that he does with the kid in Close Encounters of the Third Kind, like getting him to react to things by giving him toys and, like, dressing up like a monkey? Well, when you're dealing with an adult, fear is really the best motivator. Also, on the time when they were at that set, Vivian Kubrick, the daughter of Stanley Kubrick, felt that the snakes may have been in some danger. And so she actually reported the set to the Royal Society for Prevention of Cruelty to Animals, and they lost like a day and a half of shooting and all this stuff. So that's when they brought in a lot of the rubber snakes that you then see later on. Filming then went to the Rixmanworth Masonic School in England. When they finished, all the interior shots, they then went back to North America near Tunisia, because if you're on a Spielberg production, you are going to wind up in the desert near Tunisia. That's like, it's written in the word of God for him. And then in the sequences where we go visit Salah, where he lives, they had to remove 300 TV antennas from the houses surrounding him so it looked like the right time period, and they then put them all back. This was also where they did the now famous non-fight sequence where Harrison Ford got dysentery, like he's playing the Oregon Trail, and we have the whole thing. We'll talk about that later. They then were like, let's go somewhere nice. They went to Hawaii, where they shot the opening of the film of Indy running away. Of outside the temple. And then they went to the Nepali coast, where they then filmed Indy running away from the natives. The filming, 73 days. Exactly as planned.
I feel like that whole list that you just said should have had a map, and you just drew little red lines around it.
It would have worked out pretty well. And then the film, basically wraps up shooting in 73 days. ILM goes to work on the special effects that would kind of become work of legend. But there's something missing. What is missing, Miss Courtney? Take it away, CV.
Well, we have our fantastic composer and subsequent fantastic score by John Williams. You may have heard of him.
I don't think I have.
Yeah. If you haven't, you might want to, do a little bit of research.
How do you have the internet?
You're a shame to society. So we have John Williams composing our score here, and he's an American composer, conductor, and pianist, and he is known for his use of motives in music. So like we saw with The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly, with the three separate instrumentations on the themes, we have a theme for Indiana Jones, we have a theme for Marion, and we have a theme for the Ark. So you'll notice those when those come up in the film. Now, John Williams got his start in Hollywood playing for various TV series and films. He played for Peter Gunn, so that famous Peter Gunn theme. Mm-hmm. He played the piano for that. And the films he played for were South Pacific, Some Like It Hot, To Kill a Mockingbird, and The Apartment.
Jesus.
Yeah.
Ridiculous.
And now he has worked with Steven Spielberg on all but three of Steven's films. So I'm guessing they have some sort of open invitation. And if something doesn't work out, then that's where a change is made. And the three films that he hasn't worked with him on are Bridge of Spies, The Color Purple, and the upcoming Ready Player One.
I would have liked to have seen him do Ready Player One, but I also feel that the person who's doing Ready Player One is going to lean on John Williams a lot, because that film is leaning on nostalgia. So I don't know who's doing Ready Player. Michael Giacchino? He's doing everything else.
Probably. I don't think so. I didn't even recognize the name when I looked it up.
Okay.
I'm gonna write it down. I feel like any modern composer is probably going to rely on John Williams for some sort of influence anyway.
Yeah, there's always some sort of lean in there.
It's
just ridiculous.
Yeah. So John Williams has received a total of 50 Oscar nominations in his life with 5 wins. And he has the most nominations of all time for any composer, and the second most nominations of any person of all time behind who, Pete? Do you know?
Let me think. Who would be the number one? Is it a producer?
Well, yes.
Warren Beatty? No, it's not Warren Beatty.
It's Walt Disney, everyone.
Oh, okay. All right.
Yeah. Walt Disney had a total of 59. And
the shorts. That's why. Okay. Yeah.
Yeah. And, yeah, so John Williams has a total of 50, and overall, he was nominated for 233 awards, has been nominated. He is not dead, everyone. I'm going to stop talking like he's dead, okay? Let's just agree to that right now.
Please.
So, He has been nominated for a total of 233 awards and has won 120.
And one of my favorite John Williams moments of all time is him hushing the audience at Star Wars Celebration this past year when he came on as a surprise guest with the live orchestra and they were cheering and stuff. And he just basically turned and was like, mm-hmm. And just put his hand up as to be like, silence.
Yes, the man knows how to command a room for sure.
Yeah, he really does. I think I said Warren Beatty because I think Reds won Best Picture of this year. I don't think that Chariots of Fire won. It was also nominated. I think Reds won, and that was a Warren Beatty film. So he won like director and producer. So Warren Beatty was on the mind for whatever reason.
That's okay. I just thought the Disney tie was...
No, that's great. That's great.
That's a fun thing to throw in on the Disney podcast.
Ba-pow!
So of John Williams' wins, we have Fiddler on the Roof. And for that, he didn't write the original score. Mm. That was an adaptation and original song score. He also won for Peter's favorite, Jaws.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Star Wars, E.T., and Schindler's List. Other notable scores include Superman, Home Alone 1 and 2, Jurassic Park, Saving Private Ryan, Catch Me If You Can, and the first three Harry Potter films.
I want to just point out, he did not win for Jurassic Park and Superman.
Yeah, what? It's kind of crazy. Yeah.
Come on. Yeah. Come on. That's insanity. Yeah.
He probably should have more than five wins he has 50 nominations.
Yeah,
that kind of blew my mind.
It's a weird batting average.
For sure. So his other notable works are he wrote some music for the Olympics. He wrote the NBC Sunday Night Football theme. And he wrote music for the TV shows Lost in Space, Land of the Giants, and Gilligan's Island, as well as many others. He also was the principal conductor for the Boston Pops from 1980 to 1993. Yeah. And fun fact, he's the father of Joseph Williams, who's the lead singer of the 80s band Toto.
I did not know that.
I almost freaked out when I read that. Yeah. I love me some Africa, so that was something I had to throw in.
I feel like they hid that.
Yeah.
It's like, do not speak of my son.
I have no son.
There is actually one other Disney connection, then we'll start talking about the movie. There was an associate to Steven Spielberg on this film, and her name was Kathleen Kennedy. This is where it started. Her career basically started here. So... it all starts with being an associate to Monsieur Spielberg. So the film, folks, the film. Look, usually at this point we do some sort of plot thing. Stop. We're not doing that. We don't have to discuss the plot of Indiana Jones. If you want,
I like that.
I have this. I just have a list of quotes that if I read in order are... they will tell you like the overall plot. All right. So do you want me to go through those? Because that's the only thing I'm doing. I'm not.
That
going
seems like
plot.
A fun game.
All right. Why don't we just do that? All right. He was good, real good. Throw me the idol. I throw you the whip. Adios, Cepito. What was briefly yours is now mine. Stop the engines. It's my pet snake, Reggie. Obtainer of rare antiquities. Lightning, power, fire, power of God. It's like nothing you've ever gone after before. Indiana Jones. Always knew you'd come walking through my door. I'm your goddamn partner. Cairo, city of the living, paradise on earth. Except one. He is very clever. Belloc. Dysentery. Not a quote, but dysentery then happens and then makes the whole shooting thing. A radio for speaking to God. They're digging in the wrong place. Bad dates. These are all Sala lines. Sala should just be in the whole movie. Heil Hitler. Why does the floor move? Snakes. Why'd it have to be snakes? Asps. Very dangerous. You go first. What is briefly yours is now mine. Son of a bitch. Jones! I'm so pleased you're not dead. Truck? What truck? I don't know. I'm making this up as I go. Punching Nazis in the mush, driving Nazis off a cliff. Not a quote, but just to point that out. This is for fire. This is for your children. And this is for you. It's the years, hon. It's not the years, hon. It's the mileage. I found him. There. Jones! Blow it up! Blow it back to God. This is history. lightning, fire, power, God. Shut your eyes, Marion. Melt, melt, explode, up in the air. Where's the ark? Top, men, come on, buy you a drink. You know, a drink. That's Raiders of the Lost Ark.
Thanks.
That's it. That's all you need to know.
Well done.
Thank you. Thank you.
Yes.
Is that where Luke Cage does the coffee thing?
No, I don't think so. It might just be a coffee reference.
Oh, okay. No, I took that differently.
Yeah, no. No, she just wants to get drunk. That's Marion. So Raiders of the Lost Ark.
Actually, I really liked watching that whole stuff with Marion and him after watching Crystal Skull because it actually was a cool, like they did a lot of reflective stuff in the Crystal Skull, even though...
They do. They just make her a crazy person who loses her mind driving a car with only a wheel after they go over the waterfall thing. Like, that's the kind of stuff I just really don't like in Crystal Skull.
I know. I like the end with him and her, like, in both movies are very similar.
Yeah, like yeah. And also, you know, the line, it's not the years, it's the mileage.
Yeah.
He says a couple of times. So, I mean, honestly, that's as much as I can give you plot-wise on Indiana Jones. It's one of the best action serial films ever made. It really may be the best action film ever made. It has a phenomenal MacGuffin in the form of the Ark. It has a great Bond-esque villain. I would say the most Bond thing that came through from Spielberg's wants is Belloc. Mm. All the way down to the suits, you know, the white suits that he always wearing, and you know, for the most part. And it just created, you know, a pop icon in the film that it created. So the post conversation is kind of weird on this, but I mean, Courtney, looking back at this film and seeing like what it created, what are the things that stick out to you that they put into place in this film that you think made Indiana Jones the character that he becomes?
Well, I mean, there's just so many iconic things from this series. Even if you haven't seen the films, I think you're familiar pretty strongly with the character, at least of Indiana Jones. I mean, you have the hat, you have the whip, you have the snakes. You know the snakes line, whether or not you've seen the movie.
Yeah,
that's arguably the most famous line of all time. There's just too many things. Even going through trying to pick my iconic shot, I was just like, I can't believe the influence this has had, you know, on pop culture.
Yeah, I thought it was interesting because I didn't feel like the whip became like an iconic thing in this movie. He only uses it like a couple of times. Like, I felt like his hat was really prominent throughout, like, and the silhouette of him in the hat was really cool, the way they used it. Mm-hmm. But I feel like the whip doesn't become like a thing until later on, and I kind of like it because like it doesn't give him like, oh, like that's his thing. Like, it's just like, you know, a thing, like, you know.
Yeah, he only uses it a couple of scenes, but the thing was that no one had really done that.
No, I know.
So that's why it did become the thing on that one. And it was like the man, the whip, the hat, you know. But yeah, the hat.
Yeah.
I think the hat's the thing. I don't know. Ryan, would you say that? I think that I agree with Melissa. I think the hat is the thing. Like, more than anything, it's that hat.
No, absolutely. It's the hat. It throws back to all the serials where they couldn't lose their hat back in the 40s because – if you lose the, you know, you couldn't lose your hat in certain situations because you weren't a gentleman, and so they never lost hat. It actually makes it easy for continuity. He always has the hat. Like that's the easy piece to that. But it's also, and it becomes a gag. Like if you watch all the behind the scenes stuff, it's a gag of like they staple gun into his head, yeah. And like they do all these different things. But it absolutely is. And you're right. We haven't seen the whip really since Zorro at this point. I think. I mean, that would be the last time that you would have seen something like that. And so it's that hat, it's the whip, it's harkening back in the 80s to things that adults then had grown up with Zorro a generation before. And so now it's a thing for us, and it's become the new thing for kids. They wanted the whip because they hadn't seen one before. I know I had one when I was a kid, because I'm like, this is great.
But yeah, that hat and that silhouette became the thing. And if you notice during the movie, certain enemies will lose their hat.
Yeah.
And they don't get it back. And Indy always gets his back.
Yeah.
You know, in particular, there's the main – one of the bigger fights that he has with the Nazi soldier in the truck. You know, the one that shoots him in the arm. And that's also something actually we'll talk about just for a moment. You know, he loses his hat because he's not Indy. Indy wouldn't lose his hat while going on top of the truck. He didn't. But that was actually something that I kind of forget. You know, Die Hard always gets huge deserved props because it was a return to the hero of the film getting beat up, but fighting through. And yeah. I didn't kind of remember how much of a, like, a tumble and a beating Indy gets.
Yeah, that was one of the things, like, I noted, like, especially, like, in the scene where he's fighting with the plane. Like, I feel...
Fights a plane.
Well...
I know what you mean. I'm just kidding.
I felt like the whole movie made it so, like, while he was in a lot of fights, he always got out of it not by brawn, but by brains. Like, he always either outsmarted him, outmaneuvered him. Like, he had a couple of physical things that he did, but it was usually, like, he found a way to win because he outsmarted his opponent. And I thought that was really good because while Harrison Ford is not, you know, a wimpy-looking guy, he's also not, like, you know, overly imposing either. You know, he is supposed to be a professor who just also happens to go on adventures. So I thought it was really cool. Like, it, more so than I think a lot of other films that I've watched, like, they really stressed his cunning in fights.
Yeah, yeah. And I think that for the series to be successful in the next film, they have to take that to the next level where he can't physically, like, just punch his way out of situations.
Yeah.
You know, he tries, but it's not a thing, and he has to kind of work it out more of a mental way.
Yeah.
Which has always been it because they always put a heavy, you know, a big guy opposite him at some point in the films. You know, it's always that sort of battle for that. But I don't think the movie works as well as it does without all the supporting cast working as well as they do.
Yeah.
And, you know, large part of that goes right to Karen Allen's Marion, whom she's just, you know, she's on fire the whole movie. She's
great. I love
her, yeah. She's beautiful, but, like, not in a sultry kind of way. She's just beautiful. And they never dress her up in a, you know, a degenerately, you know, kind of way, like the way that, you know, what's what I'm looking for? Like, stereotypically, like, you would see a film, you know, dress the heroine or the damsel in distress.
Yeah.
Because she is the damsel in distress. Like, she gets herself in distress, well, like, twice.
But I
she's
feel
a
like
damsel in distress.
She's almost like Megara. She's like, you know, I'm a damsel, I'm in distress, but I got this. Like, she can handle it. Like, she, even if it doesn't go her way and she doesn't, like, successfully get her way out of it, like, mm-hmm. I feel like she doesn't always need to rely on the hero or doesn't even, like, think, like, oh, I need somebody else to help me. Like, it's good when somebody else helps her because she's not always successful, but I feel like she's like, nope, I got a plan. Like, you know, when she was in the tent with Belloc, like, she wasn't like, I'm just gonna sit here wait for Indy to come back for
no
me. Like,
no,
she was
she
like
wasn't.
I'm gonna have a plan to get out of this,
but it didn't work. The plan didn't work. I just want to point that out. The plan didn't work. This is my vintage. Courtney, for you, like, of all the, you know, the characters and everything going on in the background of all the surrounding cast, who stuck out to you the most?
I love Sala. I love John Rhys Davies. I said this in the thread a million times. I just want to be his best friend. I love his voice. I think that number one, like, just already draws you in. And I mean, the character, the way that he plays the character is great. He plays both sides. You know, he's working for one side, but he's also helping Indy. I love Sala.
Ryan, what about you?
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know which character it is. It's probably Sala, but I think because Karen Allen has so much screen time, it's more than likely her. Like, she can hold her own. You know, it's not just she's not just there to be in distress, but she gets herself in those situations where he has to puzzle out himself, herself, and her role. She's so great at holding her own, whether it's, you know, with the frying pan. So now we know where Tangled got the frying pan idea. They got it from Raiders. whether she's giving him as good as she gets, like, you know, the whole monkey exchange with the, you know, oh, like, you're right, he is a smart monkey, like, just like me, but he has your looks, like, you know, it's that whole, like, she's gonna give him as good as she gets. You know, and never losing sight of, because she's damaged, you know, at the beginning, he's hurt her. And the fact that she's willing to undertake this with him and to, like, and falls in love with him again, it's a really interesting arc to go on.
Melissa, how about you? I mean, I know that, you know, obviously you like Marion, but did any of the side characters in particular, like, you latched onto more than the others?
Not really. I mean, I like them all. I do really like Belloc because I like how complex he is without, like, really being in the movie a whole bunch. Like, we only see him for bits and pieces. But I don't know. I liked him. You know, I kind of felt bad for him at the end.
Like, I don't.
Well, I mean, I feel like he's just a shade darker than...
I am a shadowy reflection of you.
Yeah, like, so, like, he kind of just wants, like... this thing, like, yeah, he's helping the Nazis, but, like, he also, like, really had his...
That's not a but! You can't but the, yeah, he's helping the Nazis, but...
Because he just really wanted his own, like, he just wanted this thing, like, more for, like, what was inside. Like, I don't think he really cared who wound up with it in the end. Like,
That's a problem!
He wanted to know what was inside. No, I know. I mean, he's a villain, don't get me wrong. Like, I'm not saying...
He found out.
Yeah, but I think, like, I don't know. I really liked him.
Do you know what was in that thing? Lightning, fire, power of God. I'm a Sala. Yeah, I can't help it. Sala's so great. And I put the poll up in the group this week. What is your favorite Indiana Jones film? And I hadn't put down my answer. My answer is Raiders. And my reasoning, I love Last Crusade. Because it's between Last Crusade and Raiders. Even though Molaram is my favorite villain... and also, I think the opening of that film is unbelievably great. I just don't like Kate Capshaw very much in that film. She's very yelly, very screamy. Anyways, Sala and Brody, I really enjoy, and I'm, like, super curious about their characters in Raiders of the Lost Ark. And when they're reintroduced in Last Crusade, Brody's an imbecile, and Sala is kind of a caricature of himself. And that always bothered me. Like, I just don't like those two depictions of those characters. Same actors, you know? I don't know why it was such a hard turn. I guess they wanted comedy relief, but there's no, like, comic relief character in Raiders. So I don't think you needed one in Last Crusade either. But Last Crusade, the mystery-solving stuff is my favorite part, probably, of the Indiana Jones series.
Yeah.
But... The mixture altogether makes Raiders the top one for me overall. But yeah, I just love the idea of Sala, and I'm curious. I was always curious of, like, his life and what he does. And, you know, he just seemed worldly and, you know, just sharp but on his feet and kind of fun also at the same time. Like, you want to go on a vacation with the dude because you just figure, like, he knows where everything is. You know, he would know this stuff. And it's just a great combine of cast and all that. And then let's talk about the music for a moment, because obviously everyone knows the March theme, you know, the Indiana Jones March. Everyone knows that. But that Ark theme is probably my favorite piece of music in the whole film. I mean, Courtney, you know, the music is sort of your corner of the universe here. So, I mean, did you have a particular favorite piece, from this John Williams score?
For me, it's either Marion's theme or the Ark theme. Mm. I love them both. I just think they're both so brilliantly written in that they're both really lyrical. They're both melodies that you can sing. You want to sing them. They're easily repeatable. And, you know, and aside from, you know, everybody knows the Indy theme. Mm. Once you watch that movie, for me at least, I walk away singing the Ark theme or Marion's theme. I don't walk away, you know, going dun, 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 through my house. So, you know, I'm singing these really pretty, like, lyrical lines from these other pieces that he's written. I think for me, I would probably go with Marion's theme.
Yeah, that was a great, I love that he, you know, continued that, you know, the Leia theme and all that kind of stuff. And
yeah.
Or was it the theme, the princess's theme, I think is what they actually call it. I forget the exact name. But yeah, the music just brings in a whole section where last week we saw a movie, Alien, that has a great soundtrack, but it's very, very subdued. It's very buried underneath a lot of other layers of sound. But this is, you know, this is right on Front Street, Ryan. You know, this is iconic film score work by the man who kind of demands that title of John Williams.
Oh, yeah, no question. I mean, I think we talked about it in the thread a little bit, but it's like, if you know, you have the Sherman Brothers, you have John Williams, and you pretty much have 90% of everyone's childhood. Like that's the scores that you know. That's the scores you grew up with, and he most certainly has staked out his name on that corner. I think for me, if there's a piece that it's the Raiders' March that sticks with me, and it's just because you know I could say yes, I love all these pieces and they're fantastic, but I've been whistling the Raiders' March since I was 15 years old when I wander around, like when I'm like mentally working on something else and I'm walking someplace, I'm generally whistling the Raiders' theme, and it's just been there forever.
Melissa, so this film came out in 81.
Yes.
You know, when were you born? 84?
Mm-hmm.
Was this a movie you saw as a kid?
Nope.
When did you see this film for the first time?
Probably when I was dating you.
What, really?
Yeah.
Oh, wow. So within like the last 10 years.
Yeah.
Okay.
There's an argument to be made. Our good friend Spencer Hulk, his wife was, you know, we've been talking about it all week. His wife is like, well, isn't that a cowboy movie? Or he's just the guy that jumps from like caves to rocks and things, right? Like, and we've all been kind of making the jokes, and he's right there with us. But so there are people who really truly haven't seen this movie.
I mean, funny enough though, like I was in Disney when I was 3, so and like I had been going since I was 3, so like I was exposed to the stunt show long before the movie. So like I did know about Indy. I did know like the you know at least the dun 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 dun. Like I knew that, but like I had never sat down and watched the movie.
Okay, all right, yeah.
So
then, being someone who watched it so later, because I'm going to say right now, this film, when you watch it now, it's timeless.
Yeah.
I mean, the Nazis, obviously. Well, evidently not anymore, because the Nazis are a thing that come back. Hooray for everyone who went in that voting direction. You know, the Nazis usually date a film to the 30s and 40s. But the film doesn't feel stuck in that time. It is just, to me, it's timeless.
It is. And I even think, like, you know, they do a great job with wardrobe. Like, we don't really talk about wardrobe a lot, but I feel like this one we should, because I feel like this is almost perfect. Like, it was made in the 80s, it was set in the 30s, right?
Yeah.
But
40s.
30s, 40s.
Yeah.
But I don't feel like you could actually pinpoint any of that by watching this film, you know, in terms of like, oh, they're wearing this or that. Like, you know, I mean, apart from the Nazis and their uniforms, I feel like, you know, Indy's clothes, even as a professor, are very, you know, generic. Marion's outfits are very generic. So I think it's really cool how, like you said, it's timeless. It doesn't pop out at you like, this is the decade.
Yeah, no, that's – and also, I mean, thank everyone involved for not making it feel like it's the 80s at all.
Even the white dress she puts on isn't, you know – poofy shoulders.
It's 36. This film takes place in 36.
Yeah.
And then the next film is actually a prequel. Mm-hmm. Temple is actually a prequel to this. And then we get Last Crusade, which happens post both these films. Because he even references, you know, Lost Ark and Crusade when they're going through the catacombs. She's like, what's this? You know, it's Ark of the Covenant. Are you sure? Pretty sure. And just keeps walking, you know, and like it's just the most a great indie moment. So, I mean, do you want to just go to our questions? Because I feel like we can talk about what works in this film. But here's the thing. For me, everything works in this film from start to absolute finish. I just do not think that there is a moment that feels off. This is to action films what Alien is to sci-fi horror films. This is it. This is the top of the mountain for me. There are films with better action sequences. I get that, you know, The Raid being one of them. I'll say that movie a million times. But there is, for me, there's no film like this pulp adventure type film. Nothing's topped Raiders yet. Not even Last Crusade. So for me personally, does anyone ever, want to talk about any other specific like little type, you know, points in the film? I mean, the cinematography is something that I could talk about for decades, I think. Mm-hmm. The fact that the man did it without a light meter, which, if you don't know what a light meter is, a light meter is obviously a meter which measures light. And what it does is, when you put it in the position where the actors and stuff are going to be, it tells you what you want to set the aperture to on the camera for proper exposure. Now, for anyone to shoot a film without you in that time, okay, it's different now because a lot of light meters are built into the cameras and stuff like that. To not use a hand light meter to measure the light and have the film look so unbelievably gorgeous as it does, that is just out of this world insane. That is, you know, memorizing every word to War and Peace. And you're wondering, how does one do this? So, you know, Slocum is a legend in the field. And for that to have happened, I don't know why he did it specifically, but it's just an incredible feat. Yes.
Kind of going on that, I love the colors of the film. Like, they're very... It's a very earthy palette, I feel like. And just the oranges and the browns. Like, I love the scenes where you see Indy, especially, like, the silhouettes of him with the hat. You know, when he appears behind Marion, when he's out in the desert, you know, silhouetted against the sun. Just the pop of oranges and the muted browns that he wears. I don't know. It really... This is, like, one of the first times where that kind of coloring really stuck out to me in a movie.
Yeah. Yeah, no, it does. It feels very right there. Nothing is extravagant, but it just feels right for the film. And you almost like want to pat the dust off your shoulder, you know, while watching this movie.
Yeah.
And all that also goes to Spielberg, who just has the pulse of this film in the palm of his hand. And it's another Spielberg film where you never... Spielberg is known for his Spielbergian shots. As in, like, the way things are lit when you think of the backlit shot from Color Purple, the door scene in Close Encounters, the silhouette of Indiana Jones here, the silhouette of Indiana Jones in Temple of Doom. You know, he's always, like, backlit sun. There's always some sort of, you know, the moon shot in E.T. You get this, you get the pattern, you know, bright object, our character in front of it, silhouette. That is, like, the Spielbergian shot. But I think, and, you know... Everyone, you know, comment on, you know, whatever. You never feel that the camera's intrusive. The camera's just always in the right place. It's never showy. It just is where it needs to be. And Spielberg's never been showy with the camera. He just knows where it needs to be and lets the lighting and the actors tell the story. And I think that's always been, like, his most incredible feat is... He's the most recognizable name in directing, pop-wise and pop culture-wise, ever. But there's nothing flashy about his camera work. He just knows where to go. And I'm a massive appreciative, you know, voice of that.
Yeah, I think, you know, and we talked about this again in the thread, but there's the use of shadow in this is incredible. And that speaks to how he knows to where to put his camera, how the lighting was done with the cinematography. Like, they just knew, and the shadows just play incredibly well across this whole film, to the point where several people were even commenting they hadn't even realized how much shadow was used in this film until they actually got brought up and pointed out to them.
Yeah.
There's a lot of shots of walls where you see shadows interplay. And that's sort of how you go from there. So do you want to let's ask our questions?
Okay.
Yeah. What do you think? You want to ask questions?
Yeah.
All right. How's everyone feel towards that?
Yeah. Good.
Let's put the questions towards this film. Melissa, what are our questions?
All right. So we'll ask what the iconic shot of the film is. We will find out if it has a moral or emotional component, and if it succeeds in its achievement of either or both. And we will find out if the film still holds up.
All right. Well, let's go with the first one. I think we may be going in the same direction as we had last week, just in a different different phrasing. Towards does this film have a moral that it is trying to get across, and does it succeed in such? I'll start off. I don't think so. I think this is just a pulp adventure film that is supposed to get you excited. It's an action film. It's supposed to make you laugh, get you excited, get you interested, hook you in with the story, and just take you off on an adventure. I don't really think there's a moral, you know, behind Indiana Jones. Don't be a Nazi. You know, workable. So that would be my take on it. Courtney, how about you?
Yeah, I totally agree. I think it's just the purest, best version of an action film with a PS of... punch a Nazi because they suck.
Yes. Melissa?
Yeah. I think that's pretty much on the nose.
The punching? Yes. Punch them on the nose. If you punch someone on the nose, it's good because then their eyes get watery. They can't see. And then you can do whatever, you know, next attack you want to do. So always remember, punch the nose first. Just a tip in case it ever comes up. Ryan?
We lost you guys for a second.
Oh, sorry. Oh, I'm sorry.
That's okay.
Are we back now?
Yeah, you get it back now.
Okay. So, Ryan, what do you feel towards moral and all that kind of stuff?
Now all I can picture is the image Courtney sent me of Gus, you know, punching the Nazi. That's another story aside. It takes everything that works in all the old serial pulps. It takes everything that was great about those, but brought them into, you know, the real cinema, brought them into a established place that takes them up a notch, and it's just fantastic. And there's not a, you know, there's not even an offbeat in this movie. It's a great adventure tale.
So let's talk about the iconic shot. That's a number of different things. Melissa, I want to start with you.
I think my favorite one would have to be, I think I'm going to pick the one where he's out in the desert while they're, you know, digging for the ark, and you just see him silhouetted against the sun, and he puts his hat on. I think for me, that's the shot.
Stole mine. You're a thief. You know that's my pick.
No, I didn't.
Oh, yeah, no, that's my pick.
I like the one with the idol, but, like, I feel like for the entirety of this movie, it's that one.
No, for me, it's the same shot. It's when they're digging in the right place. And the sun is behind them, and it backlights everyone, and Indy puts on his hat that exact moment. Courtney?
Well, I told Ryan in the thread that I had about 69 honorable mentions, which I do, but I will only pick my iconic shot. I'm just going to go with the idol shot, because that's the thing. I think people would know, at least know that it's Indiana Jones by looking at that single shot.
Mm.
I think if you had the shot, I love the shot that y'all picked. I think that's a great shot. And that's one of my honorable mentions. But I think that people that aren't familiar with the film might look at that and not necessarily know unless they really honed in on the hat.
Okay.
But I think the idol shot specifically is the one I'm going to go with.
Ryan Wilson.
It's the sun with a silhouette in the desert. Again, I could have had, you know, there's 10 shots you can
so
list.
So many.
But that's the shot. Like, when I think of that movie, that's the shot I think of.
I mean, if we're being honest, the shot I think of the first whenever I think of the movie is Alfred Molina, like, rubbing his fingers together.
Yeah.
So now the question that I feel like we've answered already, but we'll just, you know, make it official. Does the film hold up? I think this film holds up in such a perfect way. It might be the film that holds up the best. I don't know. Alien is right there. This and Alien have just, they haven't aged. They look so good and they're so timeless that I feel like they're interchangeable. You could release it tomorrow and people would still be thrilled about it. I don't think this movie has lost a step at all for me personally. Melissa?
I'll agree with you for this movie. Yeah, I didn't.
Oh, will you?
Well, I didn't get to say my opinion to Alien, so. But I do. I do think this one is timeless, and it definitely still holds up.
Wait, you don't think Alien holds up? Let's wait. I'm sorry. We need to stop this train. I'm sorry. What?
I want to hear it.
Yeah, I want to hear this.
I don't think that it doesn't hold up. I don't think that, like you said, like, you could release it tomorrow and it's fine. Like, there's some definite stuff in there where it does look aged, like it's definitely old 80s, you know, image of the future or image of future tech. I think some of that kind of stuff is weird. Whereas, like we said with Raiders, like, there's
okay, like having a computer with a keyboard, like something like that.
Like that kind of imagery.
Okay,
yeah, like,
all right.
I mean, that's not really anything to do with the movie, but again, like you said, if it was released today, I think people would have some issues with background stuff.
Well, it's because there's also a story and it doesn't. You know, it doesn't have, like, fart jokes in it, you know.
There's not enough explosions.
Not nearly enough explosions. but okay, all right, cool. Miss Van Rens.
Yeah, I think it totally holds up. I think, to Melissa's point about Alien, I think there are some special effects things in this movie that are dated.
Yeah. Okay,
but
that's true.
I don't think that that takes away from the film at all. I just think, you know, when you have the spirits come out of the Ark, like, that's definitely an effect that could be done better now.
Yeah.
But I don't think that takes away from the overall effectiveness of the film.
Yeah, because it's only a short piece of it also.
Yeah.
Man's head explodes. It's pretty good.
Yeah.
It's pretty good. Ryan?
Yeah, it holds up. Speaking to the timelessness of it, I mean, they even had to go back and add in the line about a Jewish witch troll because they realized that they hadn't mentioned the Nazis' hatred of the Jewish people at any point during the movie. And they're like, oh, we should probably kind of put that in there somewhere. And so they had to work that back in. So to that point, it was timeless before that. It's the movie itself just, yeah, you could release this tomorrow having no pre-knowledge of it. And I think people would flock to it still.
Agreed. I think this is one of the easier films that we've ever had to talk about. Yeah. Also, just keep in mind, when we get to this timeline in our, you know, the regular Disney Magic Hour, like, series of films, we'll just reference back to this episode. We're not going to do it again. But we will do the future indie films as they are now part of the, you know, the Disney IP. You know, it is included in there. So Indiana Jones will return on this show. In short order. Well, not really short order, but eventually. When is 81? Is Temple Doom is 84?
Four.
84. And then 89 is Crusade. And then Crystal Skulls is more recent than it should have been. So, all right, guys. Well, hey, that's our episode for this week. And it was a hell of a one. It's one of the best movies of all time. So if you haven't seen it, or if you think Indiana Jones is just someone who jumps from caves and stuff, you might want to go and check it out. Because you can even find it for the first time on Blu-ray, available as a sold-alone item, which was another great little photo that I love that we shared this week. So thank you to everyone who was there for the thread on Thursday, on Wednesday. And if you want to become, you know, part of those threads that we do for the movies that we review, you know, the upcoming week, and don't forget, you know, we're going to be reviewing all the Disney films, you know, after the series is wrapped up, we're going back to the Disney stuff and we're approaching the 80s, which is weird. And then, you know, we've got all the, you know, the 90s, you know, Renaissance and all that kind of great stuff coming up. It's going to be really, really exciting. And to become part of that, you just have to sign up to support the show to make sure the show keeps going, basically. Over at our Patreon page, which is patreon.com/Disney Magic Hour podcast. Disney Magic Hour.
Yes.
Sorry. And for just $5 a month, you can become a Disney Magic Hour PA crew member. And that will get you into that secret Facebook group where then Wednesdays or Thursdays have usually been our days. We have a live thread with us and everyone who's there. And we, you know, watch the film together and we chat about it as we're going along. It's just an absolute blast. I've been having a great time with it. So next week we have Tarzan, right?
Yes.
Movie I've never seen. So that whole question of does it hold up? That'll be a thing to probably discuss next week because I'm sure there's some oddities in that film. I'm excited about it though. Mm. I like finding, you know, stuff I've never seen before. So I will clarify which one we are going to watch in the group. I know I have it written down somewhere.
Oh, yeah, I do.
You got it? Okay, yeah. Why don't you look that up? Because I remember it was a specific one. Because it wasn't like, oh, he did a Tarzan film. There were a number of them.
Tarzan the Ape Man is the one you have written.
What was the release date on that? Do I have a release here on that? No? Okay. Tarzan the Ape Man. That's the film we're going to be doing next week. So we can't. I'm looking forward to all that. And I think that's it for this week's show. So,
1932.
The year of God.
Right, because yeah, we're not. They have one in 1981.
No, that's not.
Okay, so yeah.
So 1932's Tarzan the Ape Man. There's so many Tarzan films. It's good that we got that out there. So, till next week, folks. This episode of Disney Magic Hour has been brought to you by MEI Travel. For all your vacation planning needs for visiting Walt Disney World, taking a cruise, traveling anywhere around the globe, visit the experts over at meitravel.com. Becky and her team can get you started on your own adventure. Happy birthday, Becky, by the way. Right now, you're listening to There You Are. You can find this track and more over at soundcloud.com/PogoMix. His website is PogoMix.net. We are LastGenPodcast.com. You can find us on Twitter at DizMagicHourPod. That's D-I-S Magic Hour Pod. We're on Facebook, Disney Magic Hour. If you're already there, invite your friends. And if you're not there, hop on in. You can find this show on iTunes, Google Play Music, and Stitcher. And you can find our Instagram, where we post the pictures, over at
Disney Magic Hour Podcast.
And once again, our Patreon is patreon.com/Disney Magic Hour. Thank you all so much for joining us on this lovely Sunday morning. I hope you all enjoy the rest of your day. Till then, say goodnight, Melissa.
Goodnight, Melissa.
Say goodnight, Courtney.
Goodnight, Courtney.
Say goodnight, Ryan.
Goodnight, Ryan.
Goodnight, Pete. And say goodnight, Pogo.